and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And today we're continuing the retrospective of programs from 2018 as we go through the year. And we are now in our summer and fall part of the year, and we'll begin with an interview in September of 2018 with Soraya Shamali about weaponizing women's rage. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now in the studio, Soraya Shamali, an award-winning writer and activist whose work focuses on the role of gender in culture, politics, religion, and media. She is the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and an advocate for women's freedom of expression and expanded civic and political engagement. And her latest book just out is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Soraya Shamali.
Thank you so much, Ian.
So do you see this as a watershed moment now, with the Me Too movement sweeping the country and now this standoff between a growing number of accusers and a determined Senate of largely old white men who seem to be accelerating their determination to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court?
I think that if you'd asked me this question Friday, it would be clear to all of us. I'm not convinced it's a watershed moment, honestly. I think we have to wait and see. I think that more than a sort of reenactment of what happened during the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings, I see this as a continuum. It's really one very long process. Some of the Republican members of the Judiciary Committee were actually members during those hearings, you know, and so I think there is a quality of anger, but I think, too, there is the disbelief and despair that we are doing this again and in this way. And actually, the charges leveled here are far more serious, in fact, and criminal. We're not just talking about sexual harassment, but brutal rape.
Gang rape. So in your book, though, Rage Becomes the Power of Women's Anger, you're almost suggesting that women should be weaponizing rage. But what we're learning, of course, and haven't known this before, is that these women have not spoken up. And, of course, they're being accused by the Senate Republicans, in effect, for not speaking up sooner, and the president himself. But the pattern has been, up until now, to sort of hold this in. And that has led to depression and pain and internalizing the pain for decades. So this is extraordinary. It's almost like women are being doubly punished.
Well, I mean, I think that it's very clear that some people understand the dynamics and neurobiology of trauma, and others don't, and they have no interest in it. And so we understand a lot about what happens when someone has been assaulted. And that's true whether the person is a young boy or a young girl, because boys and girls have equal chances of being assaulted, more or less, before the age of 10.
We've learned that from the abuse of my Catholic priest.
That's right. And so, you know, it's not just that women experience these assaults and are traumatized by them. So do boys and men. But for women, coming forward has always meant incurring huge risks and penalty. We live in a systems-justifying culture. And so the response to someone who says something that is frightening to the culture, right? Because in essence, when you say these things, you're a whistleblower. And you're saying, not only did this happen to me, but I'm challenging the culture that has enabled it, and I'm describing it, and I'm actually holding people accountable. No one really wants that information. And so people will hold on to these stories because of the shame and the risk, and also because it's very clear we have example after example after example of the penalties that people face when they do say what happened to them, of the disbelief and the doubt. And, you know, I was sort of, today I noticed a headline that said there are now four people who are collaborating Christine Blasey Ford's story. And I thought, this is remarkable. I don't think that in general people understand how recently it was that our police departments stopped requiring collaboration when a victim of sexual assault made a report. It was the only crime in which a victim had to provide collaboration. You know, as late as sort of the early aughts, the Philadelphia Police Department sex crime unit was jokingly called the lying bitch unit. So I think that it's so pervasive in the culture that saying, oh, why didn't she come forward before is just a statement that you have no interest. You have no interest in understanding what's happening. And in fact, you probably are served politically by not understanding what's happening.
So what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? Because what you're talking about seems to be on the cards. The deck is stacked against this Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and she's taking a huge risk, and
yes,
she's being very brave. And they've obviously covered the fact that there are 11 old white men on the Republican side. They brought in an experienced sex crime prosecutor.
Right.
But still, even for a seasoned politician, being in that hot seat is tough.
It is tough. I think, you know, one of perhaps the only positive aspects of this is that she is herself an expert. She understands these dynamics. She had asked not to be questioned by a prosecutor. And I don't know if this is precisely why, but there is lots of research, well understood dynamics of courtroom prosecutorial procedures, adversarial procedures that are understood to undermine the testimony of a woman like Ford because of the linguistics, because of the adversarial nature of the question and answers. And so there are alternatives to that that Congress is not interested in. They're going to go down the old school line of proceeding in ways that have been demonstrably proven to basically institutionalize perpetrator perspectives. And so already from the get-go, she's in a situation in which she will be an individual essentially acting in isolation in the context of this bigger problem. And so having a woman prosecutor, of course, is pretty cynical move, I think. Everybody does it in terms of patriarchal institutions. I mean, every time the Catholic Church has to make a statement, they trot out a woman spokeswoman to say it for them and sort of do the dirty work. And I think that's what we will see on Thursday.
So what do you expect then? I mean, there's another surreal nature, far from the fact that this deck is stacked against this woman who is the first accuser. The second accuser is not allowed to come or to be interviewed or even to be investigated by the FBI. And, of course, the same applies to the third accuser. And the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Grassley, has instructed the Democrats not to ask questions about the second or, in particular,
yes,
the third accuser. So,
and that's typical in courtroom proceedings, right, where you isolate all of the cases and you bar any contextualizing of the problem.
Right.
And it was remarkable, too, because earlier this year when we saw the Larry Nassar proceedings, what was so notable was that over 200 women were allowed to speak. They were all allowed to give testimony. And just the sheer force of the numbers, which tells you a lot about how many women it takes, right? Even in the case of Cosby, we know that there were 3, 4, 5 dozen women. 60 women in final count. And so,
but only one was
one in the case, right? That's exactly right. And so here, that's what they're doing. They're trying to isolate this one woman, isolate what she's saying, and close off that kind of contextualizing, close off the effect of having three incredibly competent women who have asked for an FBI investigation and who, for better or worse, are providing corroborative evidence.
Well, what particularly irritates me about this situation is that it feels like the tyranny of the minority that we've had, because we have a minority,
yes,
president, and in effect, even though the Republicans control the House and Senate, they get fewer votes than Democrats because they've rigged the system through gerrymandering and the Electoral, mm-hmm, College, or as some refer to it, the slave state college. So that's irritating enough, but now it seems manifestly clear that what's going on here is the tyranny of the minority being amped up. And the fact that Kavanaugh went on Fox News, which addresses the one-third base that Trump has, the 30%. That's their echo chamber, and they keep people inside a bubble of delusion where they're impermeable to facts and evidence. The fact that he did that indicates to me that this is a minority judge. This is a man who is only going to respect and respond to one-third of this country at most. Yeah, so in other words, my anger is about at what point does the two-thirds step up? And what can we, I guess the, all we can do is vote in November, right?
Right.
And that seems kind of pathetic compared to the in-your-face aggression that this one-third of this country is exercising at the moment.
Well, I think it's interesting because there is this sense, prevalence of this idea of American exceptionalism, that somehow we had this shining democracy, when in fact the truth is that for most of our history, only a very small percentage, ultimately, of the population had full citizenship rights, had full rights to political power and efficacy. And we're seeing the curtains pulled back from that today in new and different ways. And so the very concentrated power and disproportionate power that white Christian evangelical often men have had in state legislatures and now in Congress is there for everyone to see and to decide. Do you want to get out the vote? Do you want to go out and vote? Do you want to run for office? Because it's going to take this monumental shift in who feels that they can be meaningful political actors. So many people feel disenfranchised, and at the same time, so many other people feel so entitled. And somehow we have to equalize that playing field so that people actually feel that their political system not only does represent them, because it doesn't, but can actually represent them.
Well, you've heard my rage and frustration about how come the two-thirds of this country are being rolled by the one-third, and what the hell are we going to do about it? Because it's absolutely insupportable and insufferable. So tell me about your rage and women's rage.
Well, where to begin, right?
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people, I've just published this book. It's been 2 weeks. I've been on a book tour. And there are people who, you know, feel very strongly, which they share, that there shouldn't be a, we shouldn't be advocating for an increase in rage. And that's really a miscategorization of what I'm talking about and what other feminist writers who are writing about this topic right now are saying. Essentially what we're saying is this rage is here. It has always been here. There are times in the culture that allow women to display and express anger more acceptably, and those times tend to be times of political crisis. But then what happens is there's almost an inevitable backlash and a reassertion of gender norms and a kind of sex segregation into public and private space. And I think what's notably, there are several things that are notably different this time, which I hope are a silver lining to the current sort of disastrous regime that we're all living with. And that is that women do have more economic power than they've had before. There are more women running for office, and there are more women winning. We also have a generation of women who've grown up with Title IX. And although many people associate that with sports, it's really, really about leadership. And so not only have women grown up as girls used to playing on teams, learning about the difference between aggressiveness and anger, learning to work across conflict. You know, those are not skills that we tend to teach girls in traditional gender socializing ways. Not only do they have Title IX themselves, but they have a generation even of role models who also had Title IX. And so the kind of political expression, the efflorescence that we're seeing right now, I'm hoping marks that kind of social shift where the anger that we have is not going to be pushed back into private, but will be sustained in terms of changing our ideas of leadership and our ideas of citizenship.
And does this tie into the debate going on within the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the corporate wing, where the corporate wing is saying to the progressive wing, we love your energy, we want you to get out the vote, particularly with millennials and the minorities, but don't talk about impeachment?
I think it does. I mean, I think what's interesting to me, certainly living in Washington, is the number of people who seem to feel very strongly that the way to win the next presidential election is to somehow magically convert Trump voters by putting forward a, you know, a sort of nice, smart, probably white guy, you know. And I just don't think that's going to work in this environment. I really think that we have to get out the vote. We need to address the issues that progressives have put front and forward. I mean, there are huge shifts. We've seen the shifts, like even healthcare. You look at the conversation about healthcare, and I think we're somewhere now that a lot of people could never have even imagined 5 years ago. And that's because of this progressive push. So I do think it ties into it. I think that a lot of the impressions we have of anger and political anger are tied very much to the idea of an angry white man. So during the 90s and since, there have been a lot of books written about that, about the Tea Party and about the negativity of that kind of emotion and anger. But in fact, the same way that that anger has been linked to shame and contempt and disgust, which you saw all over Trump's rallies, it's similarly connected to empathy and compassion and the search for social justice. There's nothing intrinsically negative about the emotion. And so if we can capture that, those feelings, and we can channel them politically as women, then I think that we stand a fighting chance.
Well, there's no greater exemplar of the angry white man than President Trump.
No, I think that's right. He's really a materialization of that.
And he, incidentally, keeps talking about Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas.
Yes, he does.
And understanding he's a weak, strong man. He's a frail egotist. It's just paradoxical. But I do believe that he singles her out because he recognizes her as the main political rival in 2020.
That's interesting.
And to my mind, I think if you look at the Senate debate where the other great misogynist, Mitch McConnell, tried to silence her through arcane procedural methods, and the look on her face, but the determination, but she didn't get strident, which is the buzzword that's used about women, but she showed enormous strength and patience, and almost looked down on this terrible man.
Yes, and I think that this actually marks another huge shift, which is social media. So the project that I work on with the Women's Media Center is really about the negative aspects of social media that are weaponized against women. So the harassment, the threats, the impersonation, the doxing, all of the tools that are used at great scope and amplification to shut down women's participation or threaten them, which we just saw happen with Christine Ford. You know, she's had to go into hiding. This is exactly what she was trying to avoid. It's very invasive. It's very dangerous. But having said all of that, in fact, when Mitch McConnell silenced Elizabeth Warren, he actually flipped the switch on a huge movement, right? I mean, nevertheless, she persisted within minutes or hours, had taken on a life of its own because it really resonated with women. Women are like, yes, of course, we all understand what just happened. It happened to her. It happens to us every day. It happens to us at home. It happens to us at work. It happens to us if we're at rallies. And so you can't count anymore on shutting down a woman like that and having it just be a sort of small closed room issue, because it's not a small closed room issue. And now there's this immense tool that enables us to communicate with each other. You could isolate a girl or woman in the house very easily 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. And it's still happening in some places in the U.S. and certainly in the world today. But just the ability to reach out to that network and to talk to other girls and women is revolutionary. We really don't understand the impact of that, and we won't for a long time.
Well, just in the last minute, given this watershed moment, how do you see women's rage translating either in victory, if indeed Kavanaugh has to withdraw or he doesn't get the votes in the Senate, or that they push him through? Because, again, in the back of my mind is always the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump, millions of women showed up here in the United States and around the world. And that showed me that there's a movement, not necessarily a sustaining movement, but my feeling is that this is going to accelerate the revitalization of that movement.
I mean, I certainly think so. I probably, like you, am not convinced that they will not confirm this man. I think that for a lot of the members of the right, this is an inconvenience and it's, you know, political game and they're going to just do it anyway. And so if that happens, I think we will see again this massive wave, this outpouring of anger. And I'm hoping that we can capture that anger in the election, in the midterm elections, and that it is sustained. I mean, in the same way that we saw the legacy of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings, I mean, there are women in Congress today because of that, because they understood how important it was to be in the room. And I think that actually, regardless of whether he's confirmed or not, that will happen again, because we need to have parity in political representation. We need to have parity in media representation. And sadly, whether we're disappointed or not, it sometimes takes this kind of genuinely obscene display of carelessness for women to make people act.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Soraya Chemaly. And again, Soraya Chemaly is an award-winning writer and activist whose work focuses on the role of gender in cultures, politics, religion, and media. And she's the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and an advocate for women's freedom of expression and expanded civic and political engagement. And her latest book just out is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. And that was an interview from Background Briefing's September program with Soraya Chemaly about weaponizing women's rage, because so many women were elected this year in the elections that took place later, very much an issue that dominated 2018. We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back with Joe Cirincione from October of 2018, talking about how a president is out of control, but he has the nuclear button.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Joseph Cirincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cirincione.
Thank you for having me back on, Ian.
Well, thank you, Joe. And you're an expert on nuclear weapons and nuclear systems. And we and the Russians, of course, have thousands of nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, it comes down on our side to the football, the briefcase that a military aide carries at all times beside the president. On the Russian side, they have the cheget, which is the mirror of our football. So when you see a president, as we saw last night at a rally in Mississippi, railing against Dr. Blasey Ford, and we all know that his aides have been restraining him for weeks, and there's been a lot of coverage about how well he's behaving and that he's not attacking her and not doing what he normally does. And, of course, there's a lot at stake for him with getting Brett Kavanaugh on the court. But he obviously cannot control himself. And then he just had this outburst. And now, of course, some of the key swing votes in the Senate, like Jeff Flake and Susan Collins, are first to decry what Trump has done. So to my mind, what this says is that we have a president who cannot control himself. How do you see it?
I get very worried about national security threats every time I see the president take the podium at one of these rallies, and I see the way he winds himself up, and the emotion that he sort of spirals up within him into this anger and this rage and this self-certainty. And then, you know, it's reinforced by the crowd, which is just cheering him on. I mean, this is a spectacle unlike anything we've seen in America before, at least in a president. We've never seen a president act like this. And he has an unparalleled amount of control over the most destructive military machine the world has ever created. So you're worried about two things, basically. One is whether he will do something that will start a war, that it will start a new war with Iran, for example. And the other is whether he will do something that would start a nuclear war, because the President of the United States has sole unfettered authority to the world's nuclear arsenal. And let me give you an example, just so you, this isn't just hypothetical. Late July, the president, in the middle of the night, it was around midnight, he tweeted out a threat to Iran in all caps. He threatened Iran with, quote, consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered, close quotes. Well, the problem is, of course, the President of the United States has the ability to, at a moment's notice, inflict consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered. He controls the nuclear arsenal. At all times, a military officer follows the President around. He's required to be within a minute of the President. So when the President is tweeting in the Lincoln bedroom, this officer is sitting outside the door, and the president can summon him at any moment. He carries a briefcase with the nuclear codes and communication equipment in it. The president can order him to open up that briefcase to connect him to the military command authority, and the president, once he identifies himself, can deliver an order to launch a nuclear weapon at Iran. Now, this is a system that was set up to protect the country, but we've never had a president like this, this volatile, this unstable. So, yes, the president's behavior at these rallies as he rails against his political opponents, real and imagined, gives me great fear about whether he's going to plunge America into a new war.
Well, but I think it's worse in the sense, Joe Cirincione, that we know that his aides have been trying to restrain him. They've obviously had lots of conversations with him. Do not trash this woman. And he's been fairly sober about it. He said nice things about her. So to my mind, this really shows that he simply couldn't stop it, what he was told not to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that he breaks through the restraint. He can't help himself. That's
right.
Exactly right. And so what happens when he's in a situation where his aides are actually egging him on? So in the case of Iran, and you've seen speeches and threats and rhetoric in Iran escalating daily, and that's because he now has aides, National Security Advisor John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that want to provoke him, that are as rabid as he is about Iran. That's what makes this situation so dangerous.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. So in terms of what you were saying about the football, the nuclear codes with the military aid within a minute of the president at all time. So as he tweets out at, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, there's this man sitting outside the door with his suitcase. So there is no impediment, is there, between the president and the suitcase, the football? In other words, the codes are in there. I know how it was set up during the Cold War for an incoming attack. Immediately, NORAD would pick it up in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. Then they would immediately alert the National Command Authority, the Pentagon. The Secretary of Defense would be alerted and immediately alert the president. How does it operate in the opposite direction? In other words, if it's not an incoming strike, but still he has the authority to launch nuclear weapons, offensively or preemptively, so what's to stop him?
Nothing. which is the scary part. And people don't believe me when I tell them this, because they're all used to seeing the scenario play out the way you describe, that there's an incoming attack, and then, of course, that the military picks that up first, and then the phone calls start. And by the time they get the president on the line, there's already a group of national security officials who are on the line with him, and they're allowed to have a brief conference, and that's the way the system is supposed to work. But it doesn't have to be the military calling the president. The president can call the military. And in that case, there's no set procedure, no requirement for the president to loop in his national security advisor or secretary of defense or secretary of state or even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The way the system works is that he gets connected immediately to the national command center, where the only thing that was required is that the officer in charge, and usually it'd be a three-star general, would then query the president with a challenge code, and the president would pull out the card that he's required to carry with him at all times, called the biscuit, where he then has a code to answer back, say Alpha Delta Bravo 7. And then once he's identified as the president, well, then he can give the command. And so the book that he carries around, the book that's in the nuclear football, is like a Chinese menu of nuclear options, you know, from one to up to 1,000, with different target sets that he can choose, and these all have codes. And now, so he would then give that order. He would order a particular attack. This actually was all illustrated brilliantly in a recent episode of Madam Secretary on CBS. It was their season finale, just rebroadcast a couple of weeks ago, which shows the actual process that goes through. In this case, it was a false attack that was called off at the last minute, but it shows the process. At that point, the commander of the Military Operations Center would then contact the Strategic Command, where they actually implement the order. And so then another general will be brought on board. But that's it. That's all that's required. And as long as the order was legal, and by the fact that these operations are actually in the book, they're sort of pre-vetted to be legal. And you can imagine, for example, in a time of crisis with Iran, or for that matter, North Korea, if tensions are building and suddenly the general gets an order that the president is ordering a nuclear attack, they would implement that order. They are trained to implement their order. The whole process is built for speed and implementation, not for discussion and debate. So it would require a full-scale mutiny by the military in order to stop a nuclear command given by the president, even one as unstable as Donald Trump.
So I think the point is, though, surely, Joseph Cerenzioni, that we've been lucky so far that we haven't had a real crisis. And we know that many presidents have been tested by real crisis, going back to JFK with the Cuba crisis. And the hawks, like the head of Strategic Air Command, Curtis LeMay, were badgering JFK to launch nuclear weapons against Cuba. And that would have, and we now know in retrospect that the Russians on the ground in Cuba had the authority to retaliate with the nuclear weapons that they had there. So,
yes.
And then, of course, that would have led to a wider exchange of nuclear weapons. And Curtis LeMay got so mad at Kennedy that he was telling everybody the guy's a wimp and a wuss and all this stuff.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly what happened. Yeah. We knew that there were missiles on Cuba. We did not know, and didn't find out for years later, that there were also 150 nuclear warheads deployed in and around Cuba that could be mated up with those missiles, and that the commanders on Cuba had the authority to fire them. So you're absolutely right. Curtis LeMay and the Joint Chiefs were recommending attack, and there were three men that stopped it from happening: Robert Kennedy, the president himself, John Kennedy, and Robert McNamara. Now, where in this cabinet can you find people like that now? I would say you can't, with the exception of Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. I don't think any of the other people around the president would be able to restrain him or talk him out of an order to fire.
Well, you just mentioned a little while ago that you're afraid that they may, in fact, do the opposite and goad him.
Yes. And in the case of Iran, I think they would goad him into an attack. And that's what you see. I mean, there's actually a march towards war with Iran building as we talk. Just today, John Bolton was in the took the podium of the White House to break a treaty that we have with Iran that goes back to 1955. It's a diplomatic treaty for consular relations. And he pulled the United States out of it and denounced Iran in the harshest possible talk, which similar to what the president himself did at the podium of the UN last week and speeches that Bolton and Pompeo gave in New York last week. So there is a drumbeat of anti-Iran rhetoric and threats and action that's steadily building up that has a lot of us worried. In fact, you're having members of Congress introduce legislation last week. Senator Tom Udall introduced a bill to stop a war with Iran, demanding that any action with Iran be approved by Congress first, so that this fear that I'm talking about is not something that just I'm seeing. Lots of people are seeing this, are worried about it, and the more and more volatile and unpredictable and angry and vindictive the president gets, the more worried we are that this will not just be campaign rhetoric, but he might send missiles flying.
Well, I'm concerned in the broadest sense, since, as you know, and you worked on arms control throughout the Cold War, Joseph Ranciani, and one of the differences now was when we were dealing with the Soviet Union, you were dealing with discipline and ideology that the state had, even though there were some very scary moments. And there was in October of 1993, but for the fact that Russian missile officer decided to override an automatic counterstrike against the United States based upon a signal that there were five Minuteman missiles coming in, and he took it upon himself, thought, well, if the Americans are going to strike us in the first strike, they're going to send more than five. So he overrode the automatic thing, and he got demoted. So that's an example of their system or the flaws in their system. But overall, there was a control based upon a kind of ideology and a discipline. I don't believe that there's any ideology left in Russia today under Putin. It's just a straightforward thuggery and kleptocracy. So don't we have a fundamental problem here, which we've never had in geopolitics before, which is the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons?
I think you really put your finger on it, Ian. You know, these systems were built up with certain assumptions and that there'd be certain norms followed. And what we've seen in both countries, in the United States and in Russia, is a collapse of those norms and a collapse of the types of governments that would control the most powerful weapons ever invented. And so you now have this kleptocracy, as you put it, this gang of oligarchs in Russia controlling nuclear weapons without some sort of ideology guiding them or even a coherent national security strategy guiding them. And here in the United States, can you identify an ideology that Donald Trump has? Is there a coherent set of strategic thinking that he has? I mean, nobody talks about a Trump doctrine or, you know, the incoherence and I would say even insanity of the current leaders of these two countries really exposes the insanity and incoherence of the system they've inherited. It is nuts that each country has 2,000 hydrogen bombs ready to launch on a minute's notice. Why? For what? What military purpose does that serve? Even if you think we need nuclear weapons for deterrence, even if you think we need some to stop somebody else from attacking us, do you need 2,000 of them? Do they have to be launched immediately? Is it really true that one person can do this in both, by the way, Russia and the United States? It's nuts. You could go to much lower levels, with much longer warning system, with a much greater requirement for a consensus. Even if you believe these weapons are necessary, you could tremendously reduce the risk with just making some changes in the structure and doctrine. And we're starting to see some, at least in the United States, look at this, take a harder look at this. Let me give you one example. Adam Smith, the representative from Washington State, has introduced a bill calling for the policy of the United States to be changed to one of no first use. That is, under no circumstances would the United States launch a nuclear weapon first. so prevent the whole scenario we were just talking about Donald Trump getting angry in the middle of the night and starting a nuclear war. Adam Smith would become chairman of the House Armed Services Committee if the Democrats take back the House. So this is a man that might, in a month or so, be in a position to actually do something about this. This isn't some think tank proposal. This is what he believes. So, and part of the reason you're seeing people relook at these issues is because of the concern of the mental stability of the President of the United States.
Well, Joseph Cirincione, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed Nonproliferation International Policy Programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staff to the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. And that was an interview with Joseph Cirincione from October of 2018. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined by the historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about leadership in turbulent times. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Doris Kearns Goodwin, a world-renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times number one best-selling author who worked for Lyndon Johnson in the White House and later assisted him on his memoirs, which led to her best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Her other books include the Pulitzer Prize-winning No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, and the runaway bestseller Team of Rivals, the basis for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film Lincoln, for which she earned the Lincoln Prize. And her latest book just out is Leadership in Turbulent Times. Doris will be speaking and signing books tonight at 8 p.m. at the Aratani Theater at the Japanese American Cultural Center, 244 St. Pedro Street in downtown Los Angeles at 8 p.m. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hello, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thank you. And just yesterday, Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican senator, in condemning President Trump's mockery of Dr. Ford at a rally in Mississippi, said that President Trump is unable to lead the country. When you compared to your book, your new book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, where you profile Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, that is a pretty stark contrast, is it not? Particularly coming from a Republican senator.
I do think so. I mean, in fact, each of the four leaders that I've looked at in terms of leadership were in a situation that really called for a leader to heal divisions, to bring various parts of the country together, you know, to summon the citizenry to a sense of common purpose. And I think what we're seeing today is, rather than bringing people together, the leadership is fomenting and exacerbating divisions, which is, I think, what he was talking about. Stoking one's base is not leadership. It's governance by faction. So I think if you compare them, in fact, one of the hopes I have for people looking back at these crisis situations, which were much worse than ours, even though we feel like we're in the worst of times, is that when you have a leader in place, it can shine light on what the absence of leadership seems to be today.
Well, There is an explanation for what happened down in Mississippi, and it seems the more logical one, is that President Trump was constrained by his handlers. They even described the situation as treating him like a Fabergé egg, basically saying, just don't trash Dr. Ford. And for a while, the president was very restrained and respectful of her and said nice things about it. But it appears that he simply couldn't constrain himself, that he just doesn't have the discipline. And this leads you to question his ability or the fact that he's the steward of the nuclear button. I mean, that is the way I interpret it. How do you interpret it?
No, I think you're right. I think there seemed to be, during the early days after the Kavanaugh hearings, it was almost as if he had put a girdle on himself or the handlers had put one on him, and for the good of the country. I mean, controlling negative emotions is such an important thing to do. Lincoln was able to do it by writing hot letters to people and then just putting them aside, never sending them, knowing he could cool down psychologically. And when you're the steward of the people, not just of the nuclear button, your responsibility is to act in a manner that your words are going to carry weight to the country. And somehow, when he got before that crowd, and the anger that was within him bubbled up from inside, and that certainly didn't help the situation, even help the acceptance now, if they do put this Mr. Kavanaugh into the Supreme Court. What you needed the president to do was to be a healing force and say that her testimony was credible, but perhaps they're going to claim the FBI report didn't corroborate it, but he already made it into a partisan situation, which is going to make healing from this decision harder, make the Supreme Court's legitimacy harder, make the FBI harder now, which is the opposite of what you hope a leader would do.
And the presidents you profile in your new book, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Leadership in Turbulent Times, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, all of them were faced with one crisis or another. Nothing was more intense, obviously, than the Civil War itself. We haven't had a crisis with this president. And if you think about JFK at the time of the Cuba crisis in 1962, what I take away from it is that Kennedy was being badgered by his Joint Chiefs of Staff and particularly by Curtis LeMay to, you know, nuke Cuba and preemptively take out the Russian missiles. Well, we learned in retrospect that the Russian officers in charge of the nuclear weapons they had in Cuba had orders to fire these weapons in a counterforce strike without having to get approval from the Kremlin. So had JFK listened to Curtis LeMay and his Joint Chiefs of Staff, we would have had a nuclear war back in 1962. My fear is that with this particularly unstable president we have, he doesn't have, except for James Mattis, who's apparently on his way out, he doesn't have sober people around him. He has sycophants and hawks like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. They're likely to goad him in a crisis situation as opposed to restrain him.
You know, and I think the worrisome thing about the experience with JFK and this experience now, too, is that JFK had learned from the mistakes of the Bay of Pigs that he couldn't rely on intelligence from above, that he couldn't rely on his generals. He acknowledged the mistakes he had made and restructured his White House to bring Bobby Kennedy closer into the decision-making structure, all of which meant when he came to that decision in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was much better prepared because he had learned through his growth. And that's one of the things that we keep looking for. Indeed, I do, and all my leaders, they somehow were able to acknowledge their errors, learn from their mistakes. As Lincoln said, I'd like to believe I'm smarter today than I was yesterday because I've learned what I did wrong. And it's that learning process that we have not yet seen. We keep waiting for, and it hasn't happened. And then you are more liable to listen to advice from somebody else without bringing in the people that can really question your assumptions. That's one of the things that Lincoln did by having those rivals in his cabinet. They could all argue with him. So when he had to make a decision, he could take their alternative points of view into consideration.
And of course, two of your presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, were accidental presidents, I guess, if that's the way to put
correct
it, having their presidents assassinated. So let's just touch on Theodore Roosevelt. Of course, you write about the coal strike. He, of course, his great legacy is antitrust. And there's a growing call in this country for some movement on antitrust. It's all but moribund. And there are these huge tech companies now. It used to be only, 10 years ago that ExxonMobil was the most powerful company in the world. But now you've got Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, and Facebook. These are the most powerful companies, Amazon, and they're going to be more powerful. So do you think that that is the legacy that has to be revived? I mean, not only revive antitrust, but my God, think about the people that back then, in terms of the muckrakers, Ida Tarbell, who leaked all the important information about the Standard Oil Trust, and of course, Mark Twain. So two questions, right. I guess. What happened to the muckrakers? And two, when are we going to see some antitrust action?
Well, I think you raise a really interesting parallel between the situation at the turn of the 20th century and where we are right now, because that Gilded Age was an age when you had the first time a real gap between the rich and the poor, when the Industrial Revolution had shaken up the economy, much as the tech revolution and globalization have done today, when you had immigrants coming into the country, when there were big companies swallowing up small companies, and the inequities of the age were so glaring. And luckily, Teddy Roosevelt came along and not only broke up the big companies to some extent, but he also understood that you had to have a square deal for the rich and the poor, the capitalist and the wage worker, and instituted a series of regulations of big business, of the railroads, you know, of the various companies that were important to get government into this mix of private enterprise. And we're facing a similar situation today. Again, the rural areas feel cut off from the cities, just as they did at the turn of the 20th century. You had all these inventions at the turn of the 20th century, the automobile and the telephone and the telegraph, which made people anxious and wanting to go back to an earlier time. And, of course, we have the same pace of life today. So, but the answer calls for looking at the situation and trying to make the situation better, and whether some of those steps are antitrust, whether they're regulation, or whether they're, as Teddy was saying, a square deal on both sides, I think is what is in called for today. But we have to think about how to deal with this economy and the social and cultural divisions that are facing us today, and how to make it more equitable so that people feel a sense of being common. Teddy Roosevelt said the rock of democracy would founder at the time when people no longer regarded each other as Americans, but rather as the other from different classes, sections, or regions. And you're right about Ida Tarbell. I mean, she's my hero in a lot of ways, a woman who was able to investigate the unfair means by which Standard Oil had reached its eminence, and eventually her research helped to break up Standard Oil. But then, of course, all the little Standard Oils became huge companies, including Exxon, as you point out.
So let's turn to President Lyndon Johnson, who you work for, and your husband Richard Goodwin also worked for him, and I used to interview Richard many years ago.
No kidding.
Yeah,
oh, boy.
Yeah. It feels like such a bygone era when you think about how much LBJ accomplished: the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, and so much more. So I guess the question that comes to mind is, what happened to the liberals in this country? When you think back at LBJ's time and how much he got done, and for quite some time after, all the way through the 70s, the liberals dominated the Senate, the House, and the Supreme Court. I mean, arguably, when we talk about liberals on the Supreme Court, many of them could be really categorized as centrist, not like the real liberals that we had back in those days with William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, etc. So it feels to me, and I don't know what the answer is, but somehow when you look at what happened today, where the Republicans just roll the Democrats and they're going to buffalo this guy onto the Supreme Court, and he's so troubling because he's so nakedly partisan, that if you're a Democrat or a Democratic governor going before the Supreme Court with Brett Kavanaugh on the bench, you are not going to be treated fairly. That's just obvious. So am I correct in suggesting something happened where we had a liberal majority in this country and in all branches of the government, and now we seem to have a conservative majority in all branches of the government?
Well, I think there was a shared story that the liberals shared, and that, you know, liberal Republicans would share with them, which was especially on civil rights, that in order for the country to move forward, you know, segregation had to end in the South. Then when Johnson gave the famous "We Shall Overcome" speech that my husband, I'm so proud of saying, worked on with him, he's saying this is not a Negro problem, not a white problem. It's not a Democratic problem. It's not a Republican problem, not a Northern problem, not a Southern problem. It's an American problem, and we are met here to solve that problem. There was a sense, I think, of common citizenry that allowed LBJ, for example, during that time to get Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, to come with him on that civil rights bill to break the filibuster. That's an impossible situation to imagine today, that you could mobilize 22 people from the opposite side to go with the 44 Northern Democrats and break that filibuster and change the face of the country. And somewhere along the line, we still need a story now from the liberals and from the Democrats that binds us together as a nation, that understands why these people who felt left out of the system, felt that elites were running the system, whether Trump answered any of their concerns or not, they have to feel part of the solution that's going forward. And to some extent, I think there's so many silos, so many identity politics that have been going on, and there's a narrative that needs to be run before this next election, if, in fact, the liberals are going to gain, or even the Democrats are going to gain the narrative story that the country wants to hear.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Doris Kearns Goodwin, I just wanted you to, if you would, get an invocation from you as to why our listeners should get your book. I know why they should, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, I'd like to think that, you know, we feel we are in the worst of times, and by seeing that we had other times more difficult than these, but somehow with leaders, and more importantly, with leaders that were joined with citizens who were aroused. I mean, the anti-slavery movement, as Lincoln said, was irresponsible, not he as a liberator alone. Without the progressive movement, what FDR and Teddy Roosevelt did would have been impossible. Without the civil rights movement, LBJ could not have gotten the civil rights bill through, or the voting rights bill. So right now, the answer is an awakened citizenry for us. It's the way we come together that's going to make the difference right now. And I do think there are signs of awakening. We're seeing it in the renewed interest in politics among the young. We're seeing it in record-breaking numbers of women that are running for office for the first time. So it's really on us right now to see what we can do and not just wait for leaders to lead us, but to lead the leaders from the bottom up, which is why change and social justice has always happened in the past. And this book shows that that combination of the leader fitted for the time and an aroused citizenry working in tandem with those leaders really were able to bring about positive social justice, economic opportunity, change that made our nation stronger.
Well, just
I think it gives us hope. I hope it gives us hope and it stimulates us to act.
Right. Well, just in closing, though, I think you could make the case, surely, that throughout history, going back through slavery and all of the great challenges, World War II, fascism, civil rights, human rights, women's rights, it's always been the liberals that did the heavy lifting. The conservatives just said no all the way through history. So why are liberals defensive? They should be proud of what they've achieved.
I agree with you totally. I mean, you look back, and I think even now, 50 years from LBJ's leaving office, and of course the war in Vietnam cut that legacy in two, but think of what was achieved during that period of time. That's part of the foundation of our everyday life today. Civil rights, voting rights, fair housing, Medicare, aid to education, NPR, PBS, Head Start, immigration reform. It's an extraordinary record to be proud of. And the alliances that came out of World War II during Truman's administration, it's an extraordinary thing to be proud of. And you have to run on pride of what you've accomplished and moving forward into a future that's built on similar kinds of situations that you brought to bear that leadership in the past.
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're so very welcome. Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's a world-renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times number one best-selling author, who worked for Lyndon Johnson in the White House and later assisted him on his memoirs, which led to her best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Her other books include the Pulitzer Prize-winning No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, and the runaway bestseller Team of Rivals, the basis for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film Lincoln, for which she earned the Lincoln Prize. And her latest book just out is Leadership in Turbulent Times. And that was an interview from Background Briefing's program in October of 2018 with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing from summer, fall of 2018, and we'll be back with the programs from the fall and winter of 2018.
time will